his, her tears mingling with his. I love you, I love you, I love you. A whirl of darkness, an icy cold blast, an angry, resentful howl that seemed to tear through her. Darkness again. Through the darkness to save her came a sense of Mrs. Watsit's presence, so that she knew it could not be it who now had her in its clutches. And then, the feel of earth beneath her, of something in her arms, and she was rolling over on the sweet-smelling autumnal earth, and Charles Wallace was crying out, Meg! Oh, Meg! Now she was hugging him close to her, and his little arms were clasped tightly about her neck. Meg, you saved me, you saved me, he said over and over. Meg, came a call, and there were her father and Calvin, hurrying through the darkness toward them. Still holding Charles, she struggled to stand up and look around. Father, Cal, where are we? Charles Wallace, holding her hand tightly, was looking around too, and suddenly he laughed, his own sweet, contagious laugh. In the twins' vegetable garden, and we landed in the broccoli. Meg began to laugh too, at the same time that she was trying to hug her father, to hug Calvin, and not to let go of Charles Wallace for one second. Meg, you did it, Calvin shouted. You saved Charles.
I'm very proud of you, my daughter. Mr. Murray kissed her gravely, then turned toward the house. Now I must go in to Mother.
Meg could tell that he was trying to control his anxiety and eagerness. Look, she pointed to the house, and there were the twins and Mrs. Murray walking toward them through the long, wet grass.
First thing tomorrow, I must get some new glasses, Mr. Murray said, squinting in the moonlight and then starting to run toward his wife.
Dennis's voice came crossly over the lawn. Hey, Meg, it's bedtime. Sandy suddenly yelled, Father! Mr. Murray was running across the lawn, Mrs. Murray running toward him, and they were in each other's arms. And then there was a tremendous happy jumble of arms and legs and hugging. The older Murrays and Meg and Charles Wallace and the twins and Calvin grinning by them until Meg reached out and pulled him in, and Mrs. Murray gave him a special hug all of his own. They were talking and laughing all at once when they were startled by a crash. And Fortinbras, who could bear being left out of the happiness not one second longer, catapulted his sleek black body right through the screened door to the kitchen. He dashed across the lawn to join in the joy and almost knocked them all over with the exuberance of his greeting. Meg knew all at once that Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch must be near, because all through her she felt a flooding of joy and of love that was even greater and deeper than the joy and love which were already there. She stopped laughing and listened, and Charles listened too. Hush! Then there was a whirring, and Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch were standing in front of them, and the joy and love were so tangible that Meg felt that if she only knew where to reach, she could touch it with her bare hands. Mrs. Watsit said breathlessly, Oh, my darlings, I'm sorry we don't have time to say goodbye to you properly. You see, we have to. But they never learned what it was that Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch had to do, for there was a gust of wind, and they were gone.
Afterward. This is Charlotte Jones Voiceless. Given that A Wrinkle in Time has been in print for more than 50 years, it is difficult to believe that the book was almost never published. In 1960, when the manuscript was making the rounds of publishers, editors did not know what to make of it, and it was roundly rejected by several. The exact number is unknown. The story didn't quite fit into any of the usual categories. Yet after it came to the attention of John Ferrer, and Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux, then called Ferrer, Strauss, and Cudahy, took a chance on publishing it in 1962, readers of all ages responded enthusiastically. This book that defied the categories has now endured for more than half a century, finding new readers in each generation. What is its secret, and what kind of person could produce such a book? My grandmother, Madeline Lengel, was born in New York City in 1918. Her mother was an accomplished pianist, her father a journalist and novelist. An only child who was born late in her parents' marriage with its established routines, my grandmother's childhood was both rarefied and lonely. By her own account, she did not initially excel at school and preferred the solitary pleasures and consolations of reading and writing to spending time with her peers. Her father's lungs bore the marks of having been gassed in World War I, and when his health began to decline, the family moved to the French Alps, where the air was thought to be salutary. After a summer of freedom roaming the countryside alone, provisioned, she fondly recalled, with crusty bread, sweet butter, and bitter chocolate, she was, with no prior warning, deposited at a Swiss boarding school. It was a traumatic and formative experience for her, and she wrote about it in And Both Were Young. This novel was an early demonstration of what turned out to be her enormous gift for using storytelling to negotiate and transform pain and difficulty. 3 years after sending my grandmother to boarding school, the family returned to the United States and settled in Jacksonville, Florida, where her mother had been born, and my grandmother went to a boarding school for girls in Charleston, South Carolina. This time, she felt at home with her gifts and, in consequence, blossomed. She graduated from high school and went to Smith College. Betty Friedan was a classmate, where she was active in student government and literary and drama circles. After getting her degree in English, she made her way back to the New York of her childhood and set herself up in a tiny apartment in Greenwich Village. She quickly found work as an understudy and performed bit parts on Broadway, all of which she saw as excellent training for an aspiring novelist and playwright. During these days, she wrote and published her first novel, The Small Rain, 1945, which was followed by her second, Ilsa, 1946. During a production of Anton Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, she met a handsome fellow actor, Hugh Franklin, a young man from Oklahoma who was also finding his way in the world of the theater. Their fascination was mutual, and they were married in 1946. In 1947, their first child, my mother, was born, and a year later, the new parents made the radical decision to abandon the demands of life in the theater forever in favor of a more conventional family life. They bought a house they called Crosswicks in rural Connecticut, ran the local general store, and raised their family. Looking back, I am not sure they were well suited or prepared for this new life. In fact, the next 10 years proved to be difficult and painful for my grandmother. Leaving the spark and energy of New York City and the stimulation of the theater for life in a small town, with its fairly rigid standards of behavior and clear norms of housewifery, was as hard an adjustment for her as being abandoned at boarding school. However, with characteristic passion and her innate sense that it was possible to make the best of things, Gran plunged into village life. She directed the church choir, participated in community theater, and helped with the store. She raised her growing family as a son and another daughter came along, and she continued to write. She often said that this period was nothing but rejections. That is not quite true. And Both Were Young came out in 1949, Camilla Dickinson in 1951, and A Winter's Love in 1957. Even so, she was restless and often unhappy, and struggled with guilt about the time she spent writing when there was, she felt, nothing much to show for it. No money, no recognition, no real validation to assuage her sense of professional failure, and no perfect pie crusts or sewing skills either. She recalled that the minister at her church advised her to read the German theologians as an answer to her existential crisis, but alas, all they did was put her to sleep. Then, by happy chance, she began to read the work of physicists, Albert Einstein, Max Planck, Werner Heisenberg. Their work revealed a new vision of the universe, a less conventional view not visible through our everyday experiences, and this resonated with her own sense of things. In their writing, she saw a reverence for the beauty of the laws of the universe and for the complex and ever-unfolding understanding of it, which gave her a sense of meaning and belonging. Their vision affirmed her own and became for her an opening into a transcendent reality and informed her unique perspective in A Wrinkle in Time. Much to my grandmother's relief, in 1959, my grandfather decided he would return to acting in New York City in the fall. During that summer, the family went on a 10-week cross-country camping trip, and it was on this trip that the idea for A Wrinkle in Time began to germinate. Driving through the landscape of the Painted Desert, so different from the New England and North Florida of her childhood, the names Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which popped into my grandmother's head, and she told her three children, 12, 10, and 7, that she would have to write a book about them. When the trip was over, my grandfather restarted his acting career, playing the father in a production of The Diary of Anne Frank, and my grandmother stayed behind in Connecticut so her children could start school while their father got settled. The first draft of A Wrinkle in Time poured from my grandmother's fingers, written in the 3 months she was alone with her children. Her agent at the time, Theron Raines, loved the book and worked with her through two or three drafts. My grandfather also served as a firm and good editor. Gran read chapters and excerpts to her children, and their enthusiasm for what happens next also encouraged her. But she did not sit down to write a children's book or a fantasy novel. She wrote to please herself. A few publishers rejected the book with comments like these. "If it were a short fantasy, that would be different. I would advise the author to do a cutting job on it, by half. For me, there isn't quite enough story value. It's something between an adult and juvenile novel." She was advised to make the book more accessible so children could understand it, to change the plot, change the characters, change the book entirely. She was very tempted. The urge to do the publisher's bidding was made more acute when both her agent and her husband suggested that perhaps she ought to give the publishers what they were asking for. Perhaps, they suggested, she was being stubborn. She certainly was stubborn, but if she wrote to please herself and no other outside audience, she also, as she said, was a servant to the work and as such had no authority to change the book. Now back in New York City, with her husband working long and strange theater hours and her children in school, she struggled once again to find her bearings. After a year of rejections by multiple publishers, she asked her agent to return the manuscript, insisting that so much rejection was too painful and no one was going to understand what the book was trying to do. Then, at a party she gave for her mother during the Christmas holiday, a friend insisted she send the manuscript to John Ferrer. He had read and admired her first novel, so Gran was sufficiently encouraged to meet with him. He liked the manuscript, but just to be sure, he sent it to an outside reader for assessment. It came back quickly with this note: "I think this is the worst book I have ever read. It reminds me of The Wizard of Oz." To John Ferrer's credit, that comment convinced him to publish. FSG did not have hopes of great sales, but the company risked a low return because it believed in the book and believed in Madeline L'Engle as a writer. The editor of the book, Hal Vercel, sent out the following letter soliciting quotes. To Mr. John Crosby, Madeline L'Engle, whose Meet the Austins is on the ALA's list of notable children's books of 1960, has written a book very different in kind called A Wrinkle in Time. It rather defies classification in that it could be called science fiction, or a fable, or even a parable. It's distinctly odd, extremely well written, and is going to make greater intellectual and emotional demands on 12 to 16-year-olds than most formula fiction written for this age group. I suppose it will be a hard book to sell, but I, for one, believe that the capabilities of young readers are greatly underestimated by most of the people currently evaluating books for children. Therefore, I am writing to a small group of people whose interest in this matter I know to be both serious and informed. I would like your permission to send you a set of galleys, and it is my hope that if you share my enthusiasm for this book, you will allow me to quote you. Sincerely yours, H.D. Vercel, Vice President. Their faith in Wrinkle was more than vindicated when it became an immediate critical and popular success, winning the Newbery Medal in 1963. People often say to me, she must have been an amazing grandmother. Of course she was. I remember being proud and eager to claim our relationship in grade school, letting classmates and teachers know, my grandmother wrote that, and bracing for the wave of incredulity and admiration that would come. In high school, though, I rejected the interest and curiosity my grandmother's fame attracted, terrified that the scrutiny exposed my own inadequacies and unworthiness. Nonetheless, we were very close in ways that grandparents and grandchildren often are. My sister, Lena Roy, and I are just over a year apart in age, and a sibling and cousins followed much later. We had the opportunity to develop a deep and special relationship with our grandmother. I lived with my grandmother during my late teens and early 20s, moving into her large pre-war apartment on the Upper West Side, immediately following my high school graduation in 1986. At the time, she and my grandfather were at Crosswicks for the summer, and he died that fall after a short battle with cancer. Over the next 15 years, she freely opened her apartment and life to friends, students, and grandchildren. She was in constant motion. Though her travel schedule was grueling and her domestic life chaotic, she loved being busy and in demand. She felt a great responsibility to her readers and students. Sometimes I would help her with her scheduling and fan mail. She received up to 200 letters a week. She read and responded to every letter for as long as she was able, deeply respectful of and responsive to what moved her readers to write to her. While the majority of the feedback my grandmother received over the years was positive, she also received expressions of fear and even hate. A Wrinkle in Time has been one of the most contested and most often banned books in libraries and schools in the United States. Gran was baffled by the charges of some Christian groups that it glorified witchcraft and New Age spirituality. On the other hand, she was equally flummoxed by criticism that it was too overtly Christian. For the fundamentalists, the book was certainly heretical. For literalists who are fearful of the essential metaphorical nature of language, it was anathema. She antagonized the same crowd that would later want to burn the Harry Potter books. One of the criticisms that stung her most was readers' disappointment in what eventually became of Meg, that is, her lack of professional vocation. My grandmother always maintained that her books knew more than she did, and that she wrote to discover and know her characters, not to force them into acting a certain way. Although she never wrote a series in today's terms, preferring the term companion books, she loved her characters and wanted to find out what happened to them. She wrote about the O'Keefes, for yes, Meg and Calvin marry, in several books beyond the Time Quintet. Meg, Calvin, and their seven children live in remote places where Calvin can have privacy for his politically sensitive research on cell regeneration. Meg, that brilliant, brave, and fierce girl, acts as his lab assistant and raises the children. This upset many, many readers. When pressed, my grandmother would maintain that in part the promise of feminism was that if a woman was free to focus her attentions on a career, she was also free to focus on her family. My grandmother left an unfinished first draft of a novel with a working title, The Eye Begins to See, after the poem In a Dark Time by Theodore Retke, in which Meg adjusts to her children's growing up and moving out. Polly, the eldest, is in medical school. Rosie, the youngest, is 10. Meg tries to make sense of her choices and to quell her anxiety about what she is going to do in the next phase of her life when the daily responsibilities of children at home have ceased. My father fascinates my children with his discussions of heliopods, little pods of thrown-off sun energy that hit against the outer edges of outer space and bounce back. Fascinates me, too. Then there is definition between space and non-space, I ask? What is non-space, Meg? My father asks me. I answer with more questions. Are there spaces between universes? Can something unmeasurable be non-space? Work on it, my mother suggests. There's never been time, but the time when there is going to be time is approaching. Now that I am in my 40s, I have a lot more sympathy for Meg's choices and anxieties. She had a great deal to live up to. Although there is very little by way of cultural references to ground the action of A Wrinkle in Time in a specific historical moment, my grandmother wrote during a time when the threat of nuclear war was very real, and the description of the planet Kamazots has often been read as a cautionary tale about Soviet communism or totalitarianism more broadly. But there is no simple allegory or correlation. Apart from the Cold War, the book can also be read as a response to another significant cultural and political vortex. I have always heard echoes of the civil rights movement in Meg's revelation that like and equal are not the same thing. Comparing drafts of the manuscript is both instructive and maddening. There is no complete edited manuscript, no dates on the pages or fragments, and it is difficult to reconstruct a chronology of revisions. It appears, however, that the manuscript was basically fixed once it started making the publishing rounds. The original contract for the book has the title Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which, so the title changed late in the process, and Gran always gave her mother credit for coming up with A Wrinkle in Time. Other edits range from grammatical, lots of gerunds become verbs and vice versa, shifts from descriptive to expository narration, and vocabulary and name changes. Killed becomes overcome, Mr. Jennings and Mrs. Newcomb become Mr. Jenkins and Mrs. Buncombe, delightful becomes prodigious. There is a note on the title page that Tesseract might not be in the public domain and that she might substitute Skjortweg and Skeg. According to another note on a draft, she changed Mrs. Watsit's age from 625,379,152,497 years, 8 months, and 3 days to 2,379,152,497 years, 8 months, and 3 days, because the universe is only 5 or 6 billion years old, according to Isaac Asimov. In early drafts, Meg and her mother discuss Charles Wallace at greater length. Instead of calling Charles Wallace simply new, as she does in the final version, Mrs. Murray calls him a mutant and suggests that he is the next step in the evolution of human consciousness. The most significant revisions are to chapters 8 and 9, which take place on the planet Kamazots. In early drafts, more time is spent explaining the mechanics of how communication is possible, how and why do people on Kamazot speak and understand English, and suggesting the evolutionary history of the alien planet. When Calvin, Meg, and Mr. Murray make their desperate tesser from Kamazots to Ixchel, Mr. Murray tries to explain to Meg and Calvin the nature of the Dark Thing and it. His thesis has an eerie resonance today, positing that a planet can become dark because of totalitarianism, and specific dictators are named on both sides of the political spectrum. But a planet can also become dark because of too strong a desire for security, the greatest evil there is. Meg resists her father's analysis. What's wrong with wanting to be safe? Mr. Murray insists that lust for security forces false choices and a panicked search for safety and conformity. This reminded me that my grandmother would get very annoyed when anyone would talk about the power of love. Love, she insisted, is not power, which she considered always coercive. To love is to be vulnerable, and it is only in vulnerability and risk, not safety and security, that we overcome darkness. These changes and transformations to the various drafts, I think, made the book more subtle, more open to individual imagination and inference, and hence more enduring. They made room for the exploration of larger themes without the distraction of details and explanations that might have stifled the individual response and interpretation that has been so rich and long-standing. Many of the book's themes are also startlingly contemporary, speaking directly to a culture and world in upheaval and flux, full of changes that are terrifying because those changes might turn out to be oppressive rather than liberating. It is understandable that A Wrinkle in Time had trouble finding a publisher 50 years ago, given that it remains an anomaly to this day, still defying the categories. That very uniqueness, the way it is set apart from the ordinary, is also why it remains so well-read and well-loved. Some people are scared of it. The book is still vilified and challenged. At the same time, in today's vastly different landscape of both science fiction and young adult fiction, its blending of scientific and spiritual concepts and its unabashed optimism might seem rather tame or naive. What made it successful in 1962, however, are the same things that have kept it on reading lists ever since. It offers a well-crafted, suspenseful story with interesting, quirky, and yet relatable characters. I also think that Grant's exuberant and unambivalent embrace of the imagery and language of both science and spirituality to address questions of meaning is exhilarating and beguiling, and readers of all ages can successfully integrate them. Additionally, my grandmother gave us protagonists who are heroic, not in spite of their imperfections, but because of them. For the most part, Meg and Calvin are pretty ordinary, and yet they have the capacity and the strength to make difficult choices, help each other, and save the universe. After all, how many of us are going to discover that we have magical powers or were actually born demigods? Nevertheless, we all might discover one day that we are called to accept our faults, risk being vulnerable, and, in the course of things, overcome darkness.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle. Read for you by Hope Davis, with an appreciation read by Ava DuVernay, a foreword read by the author, and an afterword read by Charlotte Jones Voiklis. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 1962 by Crosswicks Limited. An appreciation text copyright 2017 by Ava DuVernay. Afterword text copyright 2012 by Charlotte Jones Voiklis. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.